Blog Talk Radio.
All the stars of the older.
8:30 Central Time. 8:30 Central Time here at Blog Talk Radio. For the moment, I just want to let everybody know the Saturday show, I would like to go ahead and have that as just the weekend review. There's so much crap going on. And I intend to partner with several people so we can network and see what other people are talking about. That's right. Every day at 8:30. So I heard something recently about the slave trade. And it was the discussion was on TRS. Tyrone Thompson, his show, and it was asking, what was America like before 1492, and what were we doing before 1492, before Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue? That was a interesting discussion. Because a lot of people brought stuff to the table, and there's a lot of stuff that was relevant, and you can go ahead and research it. So I'm going to play some Dr. Clark, and I need to hear more about that discussion of what happened before 1492, because I think that's a critical time in our history. Most people don't want to listen to history, because I think it's so freaking painful. Black folks are trying to do all they can to go ahead and forget it, don't know about it, don't want to hear about it because they don't feel it's relevant to what's going on today. And I say this, you can't know where you're going until you know where you've been. You can't determine your future until you know your past. So let's hear some Dr. Clark.
In this Black History Month edition, we'll take a look at the monstrosity of the slave trade. Our guests will be Professor John Henry Clark and Professor Leonard Jeffries. We'll get started in a moment. It is. The slave trade, where can it really, its origins really be traced when it comes to that which was exacted upon the Africans?
You have to make a clear separation between the Atlantic slave trade. The Arab slave trade that came 600 years before the Atlantic slave trade, biblical slave trade, and the fact that at first there was no word for slaves because no one had ever been one. Yet through most of human existence there have been forms of servitude, forms of indentured servitude that cannot be compared with the Atlantic slave trade. That was a form of chattel slavery as against indentured servitude. You have to look deep in the human family and identify that weakness in most people to make them arrive at the conclusion that someone else is supposed to do that work.
Mm-hmm.
Once we look at this, we look at the Atlantic slave trade, the most monstrous of all slave trades in history, and the greatest single holocaust against any people in human history. Then we will see the others in greater perspective. When we look at the slave trade in the United States, you have to take into consideration a major factor that has not been taken into consideration, that for the first 100 years, it was a form of indentured servitude as against chattel slavery. Look at the economic reason that made indentured servitude be transformed into chattel slavery.
But on the Arab slave trade, just what was that about and how was it exacted?
The Arab slave trade was in East Africa mainly. And after the Africans had a basic rule about foreigners coming inland. But the Arab moved down the coast of East Africa, ingratiating himself to certain African families, marrying into the family, and converting the rest of the family. And after two generations, the Arabs had created a dark-skinned Arab who could go inland and facilitate the Arab slave trade. But the Arab slave trade, which started soon after the rise of Islam, and actually there was a form of Arab slave trade before the rise of Islam. There's excellent work on it, including East Africa and its invaders, and Johnson's famous work, The Colonization of Africa by Alien Races. The best recent work on the Arab slave trade is Slavery in the Indian Ocean, and UNESCO Documents 2 that can be had at the United Nations bookstore, any comparable bookstore. And most slave trades come out of a rationale in the religion of the people of the enslavers. This is true of slavery in the Hebrew tradition, the Christian tradition, and in the Arab tradition. Every slave trader finds a phase or a rationale in his religion that proposed to justify the slavery.
Where did most of the slaves come from in Africa, and where were they taken to?
The Arab slave trade was mostly from the east coast of Africa, middle and lower and southeast. A lot of the Arab slaves went to Asia.
To Asia?
A lot of them were, the conquerors of India have never trusted local armies because they were conquerors. And if they armed the people they conquered, they might throw them out again. So many times the Africans served as mercenary soldiers in India. In fact, the river Ganges is named after an African general who distinguished himself in India. Many of these Africans who were taken to India as mercenary soldiers became citizens, and some one became governor of Bengal. And all of this is told concisely in Professor Joseph Harris's little book, The African Presence in Asia, which deals more specifically with the African presence in India.
So the Arab slave trade really had nothing to do with the European entrance into the African continent and the Atlantic slave trade.
No, it came later on, but not at first. The end of the Arab slave trade came at the time, not the end of it, but the not a part of it. It came at the time the Portuguese had moved around to East Africa. Remember, the Portuguese and the Spanish led in the slave trade. The British were out of it for almost the first 150 years because the difference of opinion the British had with Catholicism. The favorite politicians around the paper trip, the Pope, were the Spanish and the Portuguese, principally the Portuguese. And so they got a head start in the trade. And once the British awakened to the games of being played, they came in furious and mad, and they drove the Portuguese out of the West African slave trade. Eventually, they were expelled from the Congo slave trade, and they moved around to East Africa. Now, a partnership was developed, but with the Portuguese moving up from the south, which is now Mozambique and Zimbabwe, and the Arabs coming from the north. These were the Omani Arabs in the area that is now Kuwait and Oman. The Omani Arabs were the most vicious of all of the Arab slave traders, and they were established a headquarters at the island of Zanzibar that was the largest slave-holding station in the whole world. But they would form a partnership with the Portuguese, and these slaves would be sent to South America and to the Portuguese areas. Then some would go on the general market. But once the British entered the West African slave trade and became the dominant factor in the slave trade, the British turned this dirty business into a business. They organized it. Territory, just like intelligent gangsters. If you agree not to cover beyond this territory, I'll leave you alone if you don't interfere with my territory. But the British put it on a territorial business and a basic agreement people for trade and save markets.
All right, let me interrupt. We need to take a break. We'll be back with more right after this. What was the rationale, and how many today, young people in particular, wonder how such a great civilization, so many great civilizations in Africa, came to be overwhelmed by the slave trade? How did that process take place?
Well, that, I think, is the heart of the matter, Tom, where that question is being raised, because the slave trading that impacted on Africa has to be put into its historical context. As Professor Clark is outlining, it was not an activity that impacted only on the African continent. It became an international relationship linking, a tripartite relationship linking Europe with Africa, with the Western Hemisphere. I try to put it in the context of seeing a sweep of history. In the period before the establishment of the transatlantic slave trade, which the European nations were heavily involved in, engineered, conceived, maintained, and sustained. In the years before, Europe was in chaos. That period of time I refer to as Europe being land poor, resource poor, people poor. The bubonic plague had wiped out a good part of the population in the 1300s, 1349-50. The chaos in the Catholic Church was visible in the 1300s. There were two popes, one in Avignon in France, another in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
The Crusades had devastated Europe in the insanity of armies traveling across the so-called Middle East to rescue Jerusalem. Europe was in chaos. In the Sun Belt around the world, there was a flower. There was a golden age. There was a golden age along the west coast of Africa with those nations and civilizations we... was Benin and Ife. There was a flowering in the Sudanic areas of the Niger River Belt, where there were these successive empires of Ghana, Mali, and Sangai. In the New World, there was a flowering in the high Andes of the Inca peoples, and in Central America of the Mayans and the Aztecs, later contributing to that development. So there was this flowering. So we have to ask ourselves, what happened? My approach is that there was a 50-year turning point of history, 1482 to 1536. In that period of time, by accidents of history, the European was able to move from the wings of history onto center stage and push everybody else off.
And what was the vehicle?
Accidents of history.
What was the vehicle?
Those circumstances that came from that Professor Clark talked about, the icebox of Europe. The Europeans wanting to get to the wealth of the people of the sun. The tales of Marco Polo had fed into this. The pilgrimage of Mansa Musa, the great African empire emperor, who went from his nation in Mali across North Africa onto Mecca, 1324-25. So this greed and this need for other people's wealth became real.
But how could a people from a continent in decline overcome a continent that was in full flower?
Well, you got to take into consideration who had the gun and who did not have the gun. In Europe's isolation, they had lost the concept of longitude and latitude. The Africans, Arabs, and the Berbers at the University of Salamanca in Spain had preserved the information on the maritime skill coming out of the great technical nation of that day, China. Once the European learned what to do with ships at sea again, he realized that he had to get outside of Europe to find some food. He joined looking to Asia for the great spices, looking for something, the sweets and the spices, something to put on that awful European food so he could eat it. He discovered Africa en route. They did not come to West Africa looking for slaves at first. They came looking for an ally. They had heard of an African king called Prester John, and he was supposedly a Christian king, and they were looking for an African Christian king to be an ally so they would fight the infidel Arabs who had blocked their trade in the Mediterranean.
The gunpowder was evolved in China, is that true?
Yeah.
All right. Is that where? So the European got it from his travels to China? Is that how?
The information about the technical achievements of China was translated by Arabs and Africans. Translated at the University of Salamanca. Remember, this period in history, there's only two great universities in the world functioning. Salamanca in Spain, partly Central Africans and Arabs, and Saint Columbia at Timbuktu, solely controlled by Africans.
There is also the story that is thrown up that the African participated in the slave trade. Back to Jeffries, what is your response to that? Is it so? And if so, what was the nature of that participation?
Well, that question has come up to us often in our classes, for example. Didn't Africans participate in the slave trade? There was involvement of Africans in the slave trade, but the slave trade was an institution that was internationally planned, conceived in Europe, imposed upon Africa. You, before I asked the question of the technology, Professor Clark explained that the Europeans had the guns. They were on a war footing. They were constantly involved in war. The 1300s is referred to as the first 100 years war between England and France. They talk about a 100 year struggle. European being on war footing when he came in contact with the Africans. His desire was for the wealth, and he was scheming and plotting to take that. But as Professor Clark was saying, the first involvement along the coast of Africa, 1482, when the Portuguese built the fort at Elmina, was not for enslavement. It was for gold. And that's why we refer to that area as the Gold Coast. And for decades, that was the bulk of the trade, gold. But the Europeans also were involved in a struggle internationally with Islam. And as Professor John Clark was saying, that Prester John was the king in Ethiopia, and they were trying to get around Africa in order to get to Ethiopia. And they made allies as they went down the coast. And the African
How did they do that? How did they make allies?
Well, the honorable trade was one.
The trade.
If we keep talking about this, we're going to arrive at a conclusion that the slave trade wasn't necessary. The Europeans could have gotten more out of Africa through honorable trade, including labor. There's some missing pieces here because we have not read the major documents on this this whole thing. Now, Professor Jeffers used a 50-year turning point in history. I use a 200-year turning point in history, 1400 to 1600. Now, you can just example 1400 to 1600, and we would 1415. The first Portuguese victory against an African people like some enclave called Ceuta. Now, the European has been living fear of the infidel Arabs and the Africans for so long. The Portuguese minor victory at a little enclave about the size of Central Park.
Let me interrupt.
Hard in Europe.
Let me interrupt at this point. We need to take a break. We'll continue with more. Stay with us. Involvement, though. Let's clear that up.
See, in the African involved in internal African servitude, not a single human being left Africa. In the African involvement, before the Europeans and even during the Europeans. And in the African involvement in servitude, I can point to you excellent cases where many Africans in servitude to other Africans became kings in the very house in which they
were
in servitude. Mm-hmm. So there's no comparison between internal servitude in Africa and the Atlantic slave trade, where Africans were taken outside of Africa. But and another thing,
did not Africans sell Africans to the European traders?
Some did, some didn't. Some were forced into a bind where they either had to sell, capture slaves, or be a slave. This is the book by Nigerian a historian, Diabaku, called the Igbo and Their Neighbors, dealing with a small group of people of Igbo descent where they either had to capture a slave for the Europeans or be a slave. And it deals with a group called the Igbo trying to save themselves from capture by their own brothers. And the own brothers had to either capture them or be captured.
Is it possible that the African with that their particular concept of servitude had no idea what they were selling their kith and kin to into the European version of servitude. Is that possible?
This is an important distinction that has to be made. First Clark is trying to talk about domination of one people by another, which we refer to as servitude. He does not use the term slavery in that context because the African had this enormous spiritual respect for life, all life, human life. And so the servitude that was imposed if Africans had struggles and dominated each other did not strip one of their spiritual essence. The particular brand of enslavement that the Europeans imposed upon Africa had to do with a mentality of domination and property concepts that were institutionalized during feudalism in Europe and were transposed in that process as they began to develop the slave system in Africa. The slave system is a European phenomenon. Africans were seduced into it. Africans were forced into it. The first few decades, from 1482 until the Asiento, the contract to bring over Africans to the Spanish New World in 1516, was trading in gold, not trading in Africans.